You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about how to give back more genuinely and with better impact. First, this summer, the Trump administration moved two federal agriculture research agencies from their base in Washington, D.C. to Kansas City, Missouri. Employees of the agency protested the move, saying the administration was trying to silence their work on topics like climate change. We talked about that move with an agriculture reporter in October. You can listen back to that interview at WPR.org/Central Time. Ultimately, about three quarters of the staff left the agency instead of relocating, leading to delays in the agency's research and the funding they typically distribute. Our next guest says that there were flaws with how the administration went about that process, but he says the idea of moving some agencies out of the Capitol has its advantages. Alan Berube is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's also the deputy director of their Metropolitan Policy Program. Alan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Judith.
So what do the numbers tell us about where the federal workforce is actually located?
So there's a lot of talk in Washington these days about, where the federal workforce is, because there are a lot of places in the country that aren't growing so fast, don't have a lot of economic opportunity. I think what gets lost in that discussion a lot, though, is the fact that actually most federal workers aren't here in Washington, D.C., where I'm sitting today. About 80 to 85% actually work, live outside of what we call the Beltway here. All over the country, major cities and metropolitan areas have people from all branches of the federal government.
I was thinking about that as I was reading your article. For instance, if you go to the local Social Security Administration office, those are federal workers.
Yeah, that's right. And I think any major city in the United States probably got couple hundred people working for the Social Security Administration.
So what are the potential upsides of moving more of those workers by moving whole federal agencies out of D.C.?
So I think the rationale for thinking about the relocation of certain functions of the federal government, is a sound one. First, it's pretty expensive to do business here in Washington, D.C. Rents are high, salaries are high, so it could be a cost-saving measure to put certain federal functions outside of this very expensive market. A second rationale is that we have a lot of jobs. We have a very, very low unemployment rate here in Washington, D.C. The economy is hot, but that's not the case everywhere. There are a lot of places around the country that have higher unemployment, have lower wages, and could really benefit from the kind of good jobs and good benefits that federal employment provides.
Might there be an upside in having a range of different jobs and different levels of preparation that's needed for those jobs spread more across the country?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I think, in studying this, I observed is that it's important when we think about, relocating federal jobs out of Washington, D.C., that, we'd not only look for places that need more jobs, but we look for places that have the kinds of workers or the kinds of local economies where certain federal functions would fit best. So if you wanted to relocate, say, the Patent and Trademark Office, which is mostly lawyers and scientists and scientific lawyers, you don't want to drop that down in the middle of a cornfield somewhere. You got to take it to a place where you have legal expertise and scientific expertise. Now, lots of states and lots of cities have that, but you got to make sure that it's there in a significant enough supply that you can actually do the work of the federal government in that place.
So it sounds like it's not just going where maybe an influx of jobs could benefit the economy, but maybe a place that has private sector and also maybe academic sector, people who are already engaged in whatever industry makes the most sense, close by.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So, look, there are a lot of big urban centers in the United States that could use more quality employment. So it's not that you have to put it in a rural area. You want to put it where you have enough workers and you have skilled workers. Think about the Centers for Disease Control, right? It's in Atlanta, and Atlanta has a great university system, and it has a great medical facilities. And so there's just a great interplay between the scientists and the medical specialists who work at the CDC and the rest of the economy. And so you want to look for that kind of relationship between higher education, business, and the government when you think about relocating other federal functions.
So you've looked at a U.S. Senate bill called the Helping Infrastructure Restore the Economy, or the HIRE Act. Tell us what is in there that would dictate the kind of moves that we're talking about.
Yeah, so that's a bill that was introduced by Senator Hawley from Missouri and Senator Blackburn from Tennessee a couple of months ago. And it would move 10 different federal agencies, actually the whole of the agency, not just certain functions of those agencies, outside of Washington, D.C. So it's moving the U.S. Department of Agriculture to Missouri, moving the U.S. Department of Education to Tennessee. So those senators get their agencies. But then you've got Department of Commerce going to Pennsylvania, Department of Energy going to Kentucky. And at a very superficial level, sure, you could make a case for those states having some of the kinds of background and expertise and location that, you know, might work for those agencies. Missouri is an agricultural state. Sure, let's put the Department of Agriculture there. But I think that bill seriously overlooks the significant transition costs in putting an entire agency outside of Washington, D.C., plus the fact that, you know, people who work at these agencies need to work with people at other agencies of the federal government, with the White House, with Congress. So there are serious coordination costs to picking up entire federal agencies and moving them outside of D.C.
Well, and Alan, you mentioned earlier that it would really make sense to put these agencies, if they are to move out of the Beltway, to move them to places where there can be that synergy with academic institutions and with the private sector. But as I understand it, the HIRE Act would specifically mandate that agencies are located outside of big cities. Is that right?
Yeah. So I think they're thinking of this as much of a sort of rural economic development plan as something that would actually get the work of the federal government done in a reasonable way. So I think the economic basis for the proposal as it's currently constructed is pretty weak. It's mostly a sort of rhetorical political play on their part, but I think it's opening up an important discussion. And, you know, I think giving us a cause to step back and be thoughtful about how we think about the location of certain agencies, certain sub-functions of those agencies. The Trump administration did this, I'd say, not thoughtfully with part of the Department of Agriculture called the Economic Research Service. It sort of summarily announced that within 6 months they were going to move that agency and about 300 to 500 of its workers to Kansas City. But actually, in the end, about 80% of staff left the agency rather than relocate. And now they can't do the job that they need to do because they don't have anybody to do it.
We're talking with Alan Berube right now. He's the deputy director of the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. And we are talking about a proposal that would move many of the large federal administrations out of Washington, D.C. and into states around the country. And Alan, you mentioned that example that on a smaller scale of the Agriculture Department having a trial run at this. Conveniently, we can actually also look at the United Kingdom because their government tried something similar in 2004. What happened there?
Yeah, so I think not unlike the United States, there are parts of the United Kingdom that are doing very, very well economically and others that are not. And that's mostly a sort of north-south divide there. So London and cities in the south part of the UK are quite prosperous, and cities in the northern part of England especially much, much less prosperous. So recognizing that, officials in 2004, undertook a study to figure out how they could, what they call sort of decentralize their employees away from Greater London to help some of these economically lagging regions. But the point was that they took a lot of time to study it. They had a commission around it, and they took certain functions of the major Whitehall agencies in London and relocated them to other parts of the UK, but sort of major urban centers in the north and in Wales. So the equivalent of the Census Bureau for the UK now sits in Wales. The BBC is a public entity in the UK, and much of that is located in Greater Manchester. And in the end, I think the research around that showed that it saved money and helped the economies to which those functions were located. So I think it stands as a pretty good model about how to do this carefully and thoughtfully.
So as we start to wrap up, Alan, what can we look to make these moves the best possible moves they can be if they in fact happen?
Yeah, I think that experience, that of other countries that have decentralized their federal employment, just look, I think it's appropriate to think about these public jobs as not only serving the functions of government and executing those, but helping the communities in which they sit. So these are good jobs. I think thinking about how they can augment the economies of struggling regions in the United States is right. But I think you need to take a long-term vision. You need to do what you can to take some of the politics out of the process and think about where you can do these jobs that do good for the people in that community, but actually take advantage of that interplay I was talking about between business, government, and education such that you're actually getting the workers that you need and you're doing the job well.
Well, Alan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you for having me, Judith.
That was Alan Berube, Deputy Director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. He was with us today to talk about his recent piece for Brookings, Moving Federal Jobs Out of Washington Could Work If It's Done Correctly. When people decide to donate to charitable causes around the holidays, it can be hard to balance the impact that gift really has against the feeling people get when giving it. And it can be easy to be lured in by promises of gift programs where a little goes a long way. Our next guest has some perspectives to share on these topics of charitable giving. Dr. Dipesh Navsaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He works in primary care pediatrics, early literacy, medical education, and advocacy. And he recently wrote a column on giving for the Cap Times, looking the gift horse of help in the mouth. Dr. Navsaria, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be here.
First, let's talk about some of these less expensive but nice-sounding programs for giving back. They can be very appealing for a lot of reasons. What are some examples that you've come across?
So some are things like these text messaging programs that send advice, or baby boxes, or programs that give away books, but all they do is give away books, and not more than that. They're very appealing because they're inexpensive. They sound kind of neat. And I think on a very surface level, people think, well, if we just gave people information, or if we just gave their baby a safe place to sleep, then we could fix some of these really big problems in our society, like infant mortality and things like that. But ultimately, they don't make as much of a dent as we'd like to think.
What is it about those types of kind of quick, easy, cheap fixes that just don't go far enough?
They often don't look at the root causes of the issues that are out there. So as a professor, Ariel Khalil at University of Chicago said, she does public policy work, she said, you're not going to text a family out of homelessness. If a family says, gee, thank you for, talking to me about reading to my child or singing to my child, well, if they're not home because they're working their second job because they don't make a living wage, well, we need to fix the living wage issue and not simply just be throwing advice at them and make them feel like, great, I'm failing my child as well as trying my hardest.
You also in your article pointed out a more insidious level of that, I think, that if these easy fixes were really effective, what does that say about the people who are in the situations of homelessness or poverty?
Yeah, I think that it almost sends a message that, oh, you don't know this, or you don't realize this, or if you really want to get down to, are you too lazy to actually follow what we're telling you here? That's really not the case. In all the families and other folks that I've worked with, they understand this. This is that there's often these large systemic barriers that keep them from being able to carry out what they want to do, what they know how to do, or what they just need a little hand in knowing how to do well and feel confident doing.
You also write about something called the poverty zoo phenomenon. Can you explain what that is, first of all?
I think there's a lot of folks who feel that by you know, understanding what's going on with folks who are not as well off as they are, it can help them, you know, gain an understanding of the bigger world around them and so on. There's nothing wrong with that to a certain extent, but I'll also say that how does it feel to people to be looked at, right? To have someone come in from a different socioeconomic class and say, "Oh, gee, we're here to see poor people and what their life is like," and so on. It's almost like a zoo experience in a sense, and you know, people don't come to homeless shelters or soup kitchens or food pantries essentially consenting to kind of be gawked at, in a sense. And I think we need to recognize that while I think we hopefully are providing help and assistance, we also need to make sure we're not doing that at the cost of other people's dignity.
In a previous job, quite a while ago, I was involved with taking groups of people to a Latin American country on delegations. And this was a point that we really stressed with them. And it was sometimes difficult to convince people that taking a picture of a mother and her children who were obviously in extreme poverty, that maintaining that person's dignity was more important than what they saw as their job of like bringing this back to the people back home. And it was a delicate balance to try to redirect what I think were at the heart of it, pretty good intentions.
Yeah, I worked with a group some time ago that, you know, we went to a soup kitchen, you know, and served meals to homeless individuals. And, you know, it was all done with the best of intentions, right? We should, you know, serve and give back and all that. But there was no discussion before or after, until I instigated it, of saying, why are people homeless? What are the root causes of this? And what can we do to enact systemic change to move towards a world where people don't have to be homeless and don't have to rely on soup kitchens and volunteers and donations and things like that? And if those conversations aren't happening, and if people aren't actually following through with that, then we kind of continue this cycle of doing little bits of help that might make us feel like others are being taken care of, and we're not actually changing the larger picture of the world that's out there.
We're talking with Dr. Dipesh Navsaria right now. He's an associate professor of pediatrics at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And we're talking about a recent article that he wrote for the Cap Times called Looking the Gift Horse of Help in the Mouth. And that's an interesting aspect that you just brought up, Dr. Navsaria, that I think in a lot of people would say they are giving because they want to help other people. But I think it's an important step to think about why we are giving in the way that we are giving and whether that's more about ourselves or the people that we want to help.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people will say that giving and helping others makes them feel good. And I think that's a great thing. I mean, altruism is something we should be supporting at all levels, whether it's your time or money or things like that. I think I'd encourage people to go beyond that level, though, and say, it's not just, I shouldn't just stop at saying, gee, I wrapped some gifts for a family and they're, okay, why does this family need this level of help? And what led that situation to happen? And how can we help make it so that they someday can help others out of that situation and so on? Otherwise, we give small amounts of help and it's only just enough to get by, but it's not enough for people to actually really lift themselves out.
So how can we be better givers? How can we make sure that we are doing charity, whether it's volunteering or giving things? How can we be more respectful and mindful in our giving?
So I think it's one thing to give to groups, whether it's your time or your money, that are dealing with immediate needs, right, like shelter and food and so on. But then also asking who's out there looking at longer term needs, at education, at, you know, more durable, stable housing, at, you know, job training, et cetera. And then the other thing is also using your advocacy voice to say, why is it that we have a society where children are going without books? Why is it that we have a society where not everyone has access to affordable housing? And asking our elected officials to think about that and to do that in terms of legislation, as well as also thinking about budgets. Budgets are moral documents. They should reflect our values as a society.
I think it can be difficult for people who are working on the front lines, if you will, with people who are facing a variety of crises, to not want to alienate their donors, their volunteers. But I think there can be some education done, and maybe we can all do that. So if someone is talking about wanting to, for instance, volunteer at a soup kitchen, there are great ways to do it, including maybe not just serving, but sitting down and actually talking with the people so they feel seen. Are those things that any of us can do in talking with others?
I think as long as we're careful about it, I would hate for someone who's at a homeless shelter to feel like because the shelter director asked them to talk to some volunteers that they were obligated to, like as a condition. But if they're willing to tell some part of their story and to help, you know, enlighten folks, I think there are people who are very good at that. Mm-hmm. And I think at raising that consciousness out there. And then I think we need to have an actionable next step mm-hmm. for people. You know, what can I do to actually change the situation? I once ran a student-run free clinic when I was in medical school, and I told a commission on health insurance in the state, this is in Illinois, I said, you know, whatever you folks come up with, I would love it if you put our free clinic out of business. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't want us to have to exist.
And to be clear, I was thinking more of sharing a meal with someone instead of asking them to kind of present themselves as a case study.
Yeah.
Dr. Nafsaria, thank you so much for joining us and for giving us something to think about.
Always a pleasure to be here.
That's Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria. He's an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. We talked with him today about becoming better charitable givers, the topic of a column he recently wrote for the Cap Times called Looking the Gift Horse of Help in the Mouth. As we think back about movies we saw in 2019, we also think forward about which of those movies might be receiving awards at the beginning of next year. The Oscars are coming up in February, and before that, the Golden Globes are just over a week away. To review some of the best work in film from the past year, we're joined again by movie critic Reggie Ponder. He appears weekly on Vocalo Radio in Chicago and critiques movies for several other media outlets as Reggie the Real Critic. Reggie, welcome back to Central Time.
Just happy holidays, and thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. And I have to say, I think I disappointed you a year ago. I had not seen much in the theaters. I made a point of seeing a few more, so you don't have to shame me this time.
That's okay. I love it that you went to see some movies. So let's get into it.
All right. Well, we've just gone through several holidays, lots of time to watch movies. First, what did you see, and what were you talking about most with friends and family when you saw each other?
Wow. The first thing is that I saw a lot of movies this year. So that's the first thing. But there are some movies out for the holidays that I saw, and the biggest movie I think that people are talking about right now, other than Star Wars, is Cats.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to say meow. I want to say meow. It was like not quite a real roar there. And, man, it just didn't do it for many of the critics and also not for the fans. And I will tell you, it didn't work for me either. This is a Broadway hit that just didn't translate on the big screen. I saw Cats live on Broadway, and, man, just the atmosphere, the costumes, the lighting, just the interaction with the crowd, all of that made it such an enjoyable experience. And this is none of that.
And I have to say, I did not see the movie. I don't actually plan to, partly because I did enjoy it on stage many years ago. I mean, that's one of the Broadway shows that just keeps on giving. I enjoyed it on stage for a lot of the reasons you said. And just from the trailers and clips that I saw, the movie just does not seem like it hits the mark.
Yeah, and the thing I'll say, did we have Judi Dench in here and Wasted? Oh, no, not Judi Dench. So I'm upset. just upset. I also saw Star Wars, and I will tell you is that some people were disappointed with this is the last in the trilogy, and some people were really disappointed in the second one for this Skywalker saga because of what happened at the end. And for people who didn't see it, I'm not going to say, so I won't spoil it for them because people are still trying to catch up. But what I will say is that this one is a great follow-up to finish out this whole saga. Everybody's back. You have Daisy Ridley back as Rey, John Boyega back as Finn, Oscar Isaac back as Poe, and they battled the menacing Adam Driver. he is so good in this. You got surprises in here, some character surprises, some nice battles. It's not the best Star Wars movie ever, but it is absolutely serviceable. And if you look at the box office, it's doing really well at the box office.
Well, let's talk about Adam Driver, because he was also in Marriage Story with Scarlett Johansson. I just watched that, and I enjoyed it very much.
And so tell me why, because you sent me a note saying that you enjoyed this one. Tell me, why did you like this one?
I enjoyed it because I thought it did a very good job of showing how forces, not just within a relationship, but from outside a relationship, can really twist and distort, even when people start out with the best of intentions of ending a relationship, but staying friends, being good co-parents. And I thought it was really heartbreaking in a lot of ways how that can be very difficult for so many reasons, not all of which have to do with the couple themselves.
And so that is so interesting. And I think that that is why this movie is really striking a chord with people, because the humanity that's in there, when you talk about all these different forces that impact that relationship, because it's not just those two people. People can see that. They'd be like, yeah, I could see that. Yes. Oh, yeah, that happened to a friend of mine. So the things that they put in there really rang true. And I think that that's why this movie is resonating with a lot of people. Kudos to Adam Driver, because I think he is really establishing himself as, I think he's good anyway, but I think he's really establishing himself, and this year was a good year for him.
That's actually the first thing I saw him in, and I definitely am looking forward to seeing more.
Absolutely. And so if we were to talk about the awards, the three major awards are out, nominations are out already. The Golden Globes are out, the SAG Awards are out, and the Spirit Awards are out. Obviously, we're waiting for the Oscars, which happens on February the 8th, but the Golden Globes happens on January the 5th. SAG happens on the 19th. So just to give you a sense of what the films people are talking about, when we look at Best Film Drama, we have The Two Popes, which you saw, and I'll talk about that in a sec.
Yes, we will.
We have 1917. We have The Irishman, which you also saw. We have The Joker, and we have Marriage Story. You saw three of the films that have been nominated. Can I hear an applause?
I am very proud of myself, I have to admit.
So talk a little bit about why you liked The Two Popes. I saw it today, and I liked it as well, but I really want to hear why you like this one.
Okay. Well, I think, first of all, for those who haven't seen it or haven't heard about it, it is about the two current popes, Benedict as the emeritus pope and Francis as the current pope. I mean, can you get any better than Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce, first of all? I mean, a lot of it is them talking to each other. And I felt like it did, I mean, it's all fictionalized, right? But I thought that it did a really good job of bringing out more humanity in Benedict than I think was often portrayed in the media during and after his papacy. And also showed Francis in a little more complicated, perhaps not quite as completely favorable light than also gets portrayed in the media. And
absolutely,
I thought it was just a really interesting conversation between basically the two wings of the Catholic Church.
So, Judah, I am not even Catholic, and I love this one. The story of these two popes, I think, was riveting. It's exciting. The transition of power from one to the next. This was one of the things where you're watching the screen, and you have these two master artists playing these roles. That you're right. The conversation that they were having, I was riveted. I was like, be quiet, quiet on the set. I want to hear everything that they said. The two on the big screen are captivating, and the story is so important to, I think, to the Catholic Church and actually to the world. And while it is fictionalized, I think that that there were a lot of real points in there that they were trying to make and trying to highlight about the differences between those two popes and the way in which they were going to approach their flock, if you will.
And how they brought each other's humanity out more by being together, I think.
Really great point. The other film you saw was The Irishman.
Yes.
And, of course, I'm flattered. You saw almost, Judith, what is wrong with you?
It was all for you, Reggie. It was all for you.
This is so great. So on this one, we have Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Joe Pesci. And it's in a Martin Scorsese film.
Yeah.
Firstly, that would make anybody go see it. I'll tell you first is that I think this was a really good film and is really worthy of all of the consideration and hype. But it is a long film.
It is three and a half hours, Reggie. Let's be real.
3.5 hours? That is a long film. So for people out there, because this one is on Netflix, I would tell you to watch half, go have something to eat, then come back and watch the other half, because this is a long film. But it is a really interesting look into this mobster world and who's on top, who's not, the rules and the boundaries and all the backbiting and all the hierarchy of it. And if you want to know what happened to Jimmy Hoffa, you might not exactly find that out, but you'll get a sense for it in this film.
It's a very interesting aspect to it. And also just the prominence of the unions and looking at that too, I think is really interesting especially at this point in our political history.
Absolutely. And Joe Pesci is a star. He should be nominated. This was a breakout, phenomenal role for him, and I love them in this one.
We are talking with Reggie Ponder right now. He is a movie critic, and he goes by Reggie the Real Critic. That's R-E-E-L. We're talking about nominations for the Golden Globes and some of his and your favorite movies of 2019. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What were some of your favorite movies you saw in 2019? What do you think about the Golden Globes and other nominations for this year? Did deserving parties receive nominations? Was anyone snubbed in your opinion? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back with Reggie in just a minute. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our conversation with movie critic Reggie Ponder, talking about some of the best movies of 2019. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How relevant do you think movie awards are anymore? Do you find yourself looking at nominations when deciding which movies to go see in theaters or maybe stream at home? What have you watched recently that you really enjoyed or maybe that you didn't like that much? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And another film that a lot of people liked and had some pretty big names in it this year, Reggie, was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Let's hear a little clip from that.
Well, actors are required to do a lot of dangerous stuff. Say Jake Cahill gets shot off his horse. Now, can I fall off a horse? Yes, I can. Yes, I have. But say I fall off wrong and I sprain my wrist or I twist my ankle. Now, that can put an undue burden on production because now maybe I can't work for a week. So Cliff here is meant to help carry the load.
Is that how you describe your job, Cliff?
What, carrying his load? Yeah, it's about right.
Now, Reggie, I think you liked this one quite a bit, didn't you?
Actually, I like the first half of this quite a bit. I think that Tarantino is a cinematic master, but his love for violence gets in the way of the story for this movie for me. Is that Pitt and DiCaprio are really great together. When you and I just got through talking about some of these great pairings in prior movies, this year I think they've paired some powerhouse folks together. And in a Quentin Tarantino movie, when you have Pitt and DiCaprio, I think it's great. It's funny. That clip tells you it's funny. And they have really great chemistry. And so it's really interesting to see these Hollywood guys who are washed up. Again, it's funny, but it turns bloody, which doesn't feel right for me. Mm. There's just something about Tarantino's love for violence, and you'll see in many of his movies, he kind of turns to that. In this one, it just doesn't work for me, even though I think he is deserving of a director's nod for this one.
I think Tarantino often teeters on the edge of caricaturing his own movies, and it sounds like in this one maybe he kind of tripped over that line.
For me, definitely. Some of my critic friends actually liked this much better than I did. The beginning of this, the first half of this, I was in hook, line, and sinker.
Another movie and one who has some big one that has some big names in it is Ford versus Ferrari. That includes Christian Bale.
You can't just push the car hard the whole way, right?
That's right. You have to be kind to the car. You feel the poor thing groaning underneath you. If you're going to push a piece of machinery to the limit and expect it to hold together, you have to have some sense of where that limit is.
So I have to say, Reggie, from the name of this movie, I wasn't that interested in seeing it, and I haven't seen it yet, but it's actually made it onto my list.
It should, actually. This, for people who like cars and all of that, it has enough of the car racing, enough of the car lingo, all the things that you're looking for if you're a lover of cars. For the people who like relationships, this is all about that relationship between these two drivers, these two people, and how they figure out to coexist in this car world. It is really, in many sense, a love story, because these guys really are friends. They battle against each other. They're brothers, but they come together to try and win the 24-hour Le Mans, and it is exciting. So I think you're really going to like the relationship part of this. And so that's what the story is about, but they have enough of the car stuff that it'll keep those car enthusiasts excited and happy.
We're talking with Reggie Ponder. He's a movie critic, and we are talking about some of the best films of 2019. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And Reggie, one that just came out this week, I believe, that a lot of people were looking forward to, I have not seen it yet, is Little Women. Have you seen that yet?
This is one of my favorites of the year. I like this movie a lot. And it, when we talk about snubs, this one was snubbed from the best director category. And again, we are left with all men in the best director category. I don't understand it. I really don't. And I could talk to you about that for days, and then you'll be hanging up on me. So I'll skip to the movie. But I don't understand that part. But this is one of my favorite movies this year, because it is a woman empowerment story that they didn't have to make a woman empowerment story. If you understand what I mean, you didn't have to kind of twist some things and fit it in there to make it rah, 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 women. This is a women empowerment story that is absolutely powerful, where these four women are trying to figure out where do they fit in this male-dominated world. Do they have to get married? And during that time, they were supposed to, because everything was in their husband's name. Everything went through their husband. And so it's the story of these four sisters. And it is so touching. It is so good. The love relationships, the problems that sisters have between each other, and even the issues that they're having with their mom, because they see their mom raising them, but they want to do something different. I think that is relevant for today, so relevant for today. And again, the way in which they did it, it was a natural, seamless way to put forth this story. I like this a lot.
I'm really anxious to see it. And another movie that really focuses on strong female characters is a movie called Hustlers. Here's a clip of Jennifer Lopez.
I was a centerfold once.
No way.
93.
No way. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Back when Stevie Wonder came in.
Stevie Wonder coming to the club for.
Casey had him in the champagne room. Swears to God he isn't blind.
Wow.
Tell us about this movie, Reggie.
So this is a story about a few women trying to make ends meet. And Constance Wu plays a neophyte stripper who is taken under the wing of Jennifer Lopez's character, and they end up ruling the world. They end up snubbing their nose at the establishment, meaning the clubs, and doing some things where they are really hustling. They're getting clients, they're getting a bigger take of the money, and it is a real interesting look into the lives of these women. And I will tell you, when we talk about duos, Jennifer Lopez and Constance Wu were really good together, and they absolutely make this film. It's funny, it's interesting, it's exciting, and it gives Jennifer Lopez this meaty work to put out there, because a lot of times you're asking for where can I find a script that gives me something really I can sink my teeth into, and I think that she does it here. She does a really good job.
Reggie, one of the movies that I enjoyed a lot was Knives Out, which is a very kind of tongue-in-cheek Agatha Christie kind of murder mystery. Again, a movie with a huge heavyweight cast.
Heavyweight.
Christopher Plummer, Jamie Lee Curtis, Don Johnson. But I really think Ana de Armas really stole the show as the young caretaker for Christopher Plummer's character.
I think that you're not the only one. I think you're not the only one. A lot of people think so. And in fact, some people think that there's, from an award perspective, that should be should get an award as well. So I would say yes. Knives Out is probably going to be one of those movies, I think, when we get to the Oscars times, that's going to get more nominations than it did with the Golden Globes.
Reggie, we're watching movies, we're watching everything in so many different ways now, so many things we are able to stream at home, whether right away or soon after something is released in the theaters. We're consuming movies in a different way. Do you think that the role of these awards and these awards shows and nominations have changed over the years?
Well, it's changing. The biggest thing that's happening are these streaming services. And this year, Netflix, I think, got 18 Golden Globe nominations. That is unprecedented. And if you recall that there's many in Hollywood saying that those films should not even be considered because they haven't figured out the formula that well. Put it out for 2 weeks in theaters and then run it to Netflix. So they're trying to figure out that formula, and there's people in Hollywood, a lot of the old guard, who believe that they're cheating the system in a way. But from a movie fan perspective, there's so many people who are watching movies on their phone or on their computer. I haven't gotten there yet, by the way. I still like to watch it on a big screen, either television or in the theater. But we have to recognize that the world is changing. So in answer to your question, yes, it is changing. I do think the awards still matter, obviously, for all of the actors and actresses. Otherwise, they wouldn't go to Netflix, Amazon, all those other services and do those movies because they're still trying to show that they're the best.
Well, Reggie, so much more to talk with you about. I think we might have to bring you back sometime soon to finish it off. Thanks, as always, for joining us, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thanks for talking.
That's movie critic Reggie Ponder. We talked with him today about his favorites for the upcoming Golden Globes, as well as some of his impressions from the last year in movies. Coming up Monday on Central Time, FOMO is the fear of missing out. What about FOMA, the fear of missing alcohol? We'll talk about what being sober can be like when alcohol is woven into so many aspects of being social.